So I am looking at the Sunbasket recipe book right now. The thing about Sunbasket, one of the many things that separates it from other meal kits, is that you don't just get the recipes that you prepared that week. You get every recipe, even if you don't get the kit for it. And the only bad thing about that is that you can get, you know, I guess, fear of missing food out, fear of missing food. And I look at this list and I think, gosh, you know, maybe next week I'll do all vegetarian because some of the vegetarian options look great. White bean meatballs and rigatoni, whole grain pitas with maple glazed carrots, black bean and summer squash tostadas, tofu burgers with oven fries and sambal mayo. Like, those all sound great. We got good stuff too. Gung Pao chicken, steak and lyonnaise potatoes, and then also really delicious Mediterranean turkey kebabs with carrot and squash ribbons. As you can tell, there's kind of something for everyone. There are vegetarian options. There are vegan options. There are lean and clean options. There are Mediterranean options. There are family options. Sunbasket gives you all those options, and they work with the best farms and suppliers to bring you the freshest and most responsibly raised meats and seafoods available. Everything is pre-measured and easy to prep. There's actually almost no prep involved. You get a healthy and delicious meal on the table in about 30 minutes. There is really something for every healthy journey and every busy lifestyle. So go to sunbasket.com/friends today to learn more and get $35 off your first order. That is sunbasket.com/friends for $35 off. sunbasket.com/friends. Hi, I'm Anna Marie Cox, and welcome to With Friends Like These, where we talk about the differences between us without letting them divide us. You may have heard this week Starbucks closed down for a day to end racism in America. Well, they closed down for half a day, and they really only aimed at ending racism in their stores. Okay, they really only focused on ending racism against Black people in their stores. Oh, okay. Actually, they had employees participate in implicit bias training. This was in response to the incident in Philadelphia where two Black men were arrested for the crime of waiting for a colleague. Well, on the show today, we have W. Kamau Bell, comedian and host of United Shades of America on CNN, the Emmy Award-winning United Shades of America. He's written and reflected on his experience of being hassled in public spaces because of the color of his skin, and has some opinions on Starbucks stunt slash start. He opens up about the realities and anxieties of existing while Black and what it feels like to be policed even when all you want is a venti caramel frap on a hot day. And then stay tuned for Crooked Media cousin John Lovett helping me field a listener question about Lovett's well-documented anti-boomer bias. That segment is itself a kind of implicit bias training and probably did about as much good because he's recorded some shows since then and pretty sure he's still not too fond of the boomers. So great show today. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Kamau. I want to talk to you about what happened this week at Starbucks. Apparently, there's no racism anymore. So, congratulations. Goodness.
Then I need to find a new job, a new set of jobs.
I was looking for information about what actually happened at these training sessions, and I found a couple of things. First, this is what Starbucks said that they were going to do. They were going to address implicit bias, promote conscious inclusion, prevent discrimination, and ensure everyone inside a Starbucks feels safe and welcome. So that's their intention.
Then how come we weren't all invited?
I know. You're right. That is kind of a weird thing, isn't it? That everyone in there.
Yeah.
And also, I like the prevent discrimination. I'm not sure if that's a thing that you can do.
No, it makes it sound like you're jumping in front of discrimination bullets or something. I think you have to start deeper than preventing discrimination. I think you want to sort of eliminate discrimination.
Yeah, eliminate actions that are discriminatory. But then I did find some interviews with people who actually underwent the training. Makes it sound a little more ominous than it is.
Yeah, sounds a little, what's that movie where the eyeballs are peeled open?
There you go, Clockwork Orange. Yep.
Yeah, it sounds.
And apparently, there was a video involved. It starred Common. So, again, congratulations. Okay. I guess we're done with racism.
Yep.
There was sharing among the employees. That sounds like it could have been useful. They apparently used the phrase color brave rather than color blind.
Oh, my stomach. Oh.
Which sounds hard. Sounds awkward. Let's say that's awkward. Is it good? Yeah. The person who said they used this phrase said it was obvious they knew that the phrase colorblind wasn't a good one.
Mm-hmm.
But color brave is also pretty bad.
Well, the problem with colorblind is the same thing. The same problem with color brave. The reason why colorblind doesn't work is because we don't need to find words that soften the idea of racism. So color brave doesn't sound any better. It's actually just, can we just talk about racism and not being racist and those types of things? All those words went out of fashion because people realized they were like getting in the way of the point.
Yeah. We could do a whole sidebar on like all the different phrases that people use to describe Roseanne's tweet, which is just like all the different workarounds for racism. You know, well-meaning people do it too, right? Like,
it's actually the well-meaning people who are way worse.
Yeah. So further, apparently it focused almost entirely on discrimination of Black people.
That's the problem with people who grew up in the 90s. Like, and I'm one of those people when it's like when racism was just up until the 90s, racism was just Black versus white. Yeah. Up until the aughts, I would say.
Yeah.
Until probably post 9/11 is when we were like, oh,
other races. Yes.
I think that, that's the problem is that it's the same thing. It happens whenever I'm in Alabama. It's like racism is always Black and white. Like, whereas in the Bay Area, it's not just Black and white.
Well, they're pretty woke in the Bay Area, but also not woke in very important ways. Their vocabulary, at least, is pretty woke. But OK, so just a little more about what that happened. It was apparently very nonspecific. Some people were disappointed about that. And here in Minneapolis, there was someone who pointed out that their store is, in fact, majority minority employees. They got the exact same training that everyone else did, which I imagine was funny for them, maybe. Like, yeah. I can imagine at least they might have had fun mocking it.
I hope the manager was also not a white person, because if the manager's white and everybody else is a Black or brown person, then they had to sit there and take it and act like it was serious. But if the manager's
it sounded like it was a mostly Black store. She said it's like in a section of Minneapolis that's mostly Somali immigrants. Yeah. So I imagine that actually. I imagine, you know, they gallows.
They could have just played Prince music all day.
Yeah, Now, the other one thing I will say is they have said they plan on continuing training and maybe addressing the discrimination against other kinds of minorities. So that's what happened. You know, even before they did this training, there was already criticism of it. And you had some yourself because you've been through this. You actually went through basically what happened to these gentlemen in Philadelphia, minus the getting arrested, which is horrifying.
Oh, yeah. The getting there was way worse.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think mine was minus the threat of arrest, because immediately my wife, who's white, was there to go, he's with me. Now a lot of Black people hear that and go, what are you saying? We should all marry white women? No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that in my particular situation, not all Black people think that way, but some Black people too, and they reach out to me on Twitter. It's just the fact that my wife was able to sort of like, in the way that like I heard some mom got on a Southwest flight and had to prove that it was her baby, my wife was able to prove that I was with her. And so that sort of settled things down a little bit. But yeah, guys got arrested. It's way worse.
But you had a coffee shop try and kick you off the premises because you were standing there. And then also there was this attempt by the owner of that place to do some kind of training to address it somehow. So tell me what you think of just even the idea of like that being a solution.
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, to say that it was an attempt, I think it's the kind of attempt that many people make on January 1st to go, this year I'm going to work out, but then they don't do anything. That's the level of attempt he made at ending racism in his coffee shop.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think that's and from that situation, I learned that there was a lot of talk and there was a lot of promises. And we had a community forum so that he pledged in front of like 300 people in this Berkeley Middle School, Willard Middle School. His name is Michael Pierce. Michael Pierce pledged that he was going to end implicit bias in his coffee shop, and then in the block, and in the neighborhood, and then Berkeley, and then the universe. Mm-hmm. And he had a website that he encouraged people to go to. The website just said coming soon. And then eventually the website said nothing. And then when I called him out 3.5 years later, the website got pulled down. So when Starbucks first said, we're going to do something about it, I was immediately suspicious. I was like, what are you going to do? Because let's be clear, it's not exactly in their wheelhouse to end racism. It's in their...
they tried once before.
Yeah. They've already proven that.
Yeah, that one didn't go so well. But this time they did do something.
They definitely brought in people. You need to bring in outsiders. They did bring in outsiders. But then it's like, you know, and I respect all the people they brought in. I want to be clear about that. But then what are those outsiders invited to do? What do you empower them to do? And when you sort of initially go, we're going to close our stores for the day, and everybody went, you're going to end racism in 8 hours? And then you find out later, no, not the whole day. Because our accountants got in touch with us and said that we make 60% of our profits from in before noon. So we're going to close after 2:30. You know, right. Like when you do that, it's like, oh, it's not, you're not even giving it the whole day. And as I said before, even if you did it the whole day, all you're going to do is sort of point out some of the problems. You can't even get to the solutions. And also because, just like you said in that one coffee shop in Minneapolis, you have to, everybody's not even on the same page. So you're not, the training is not set up so that the black and brown people are like, yeah, I get it already. Give me the deep level training because I already know what the problems are. And then the white people in Starbucks who don't know what the problems are, it's like a bad public school class. Like, you know, like you're letting the smart kids go and you're teaching the kids who aren't going to graduate, you know?
Yeah. I did some reading up on implicit bias training, and this is going to shock you, but apparently it's there's some problems with it.
One, that it's named implicit bias training.
That's right. And it is, most people involved with it, I think, would admit it's more about avoiding lawsuits than it is about raising consciousness. Mm-hmm. It is something done to appease HR directors and perhaps boards of directors. But it has very little effect on actual interactions in the workplaces. And I was thinking about why this is. And there's some, you know, academics have theories. One of them is, I seems like a pretty good one to me, which is that it's not voluntary. It's something that you're forced to do, and you're told, like, and that doesn't work. I mean, I'm thinking that's a problem both for people who of color who are told they have to do it, like in this dumb example, right? And also for white people who may need it, but being told you need it, I don't know if it puts people in a receptive mood.
And it's also, I think the other problem is that it's not actually thorough.
Right.
Because if it's not voluntary, it at least better be thorough. Because if it's thorough, then at some point in the middle of it, you go, I didn't want this, but it turns out this, I clearly need this. You know what I mean? So it can't be in the same way that, like, there's some things that I don't want to do, but when I understand how important they are, you go, I better go ahead and do this. And so because they're doing it to avoid lawsuits or it's no different than, like, I'm sure many of the dudes who are getting Me Too'd right now signed anti-sexual harassment forms.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing where it's like you can sign the form and complete the steps. But if the thing isn't thorough and clear to you why it's going down and why it's in your best interest to act that way, then it's not going to take any effect, especially when it's like when also they're going. But the most important thing is that the lattes are at the right temperature. Like, let's be clear. Let's be clear why we're here. Like, you know, the most important thing is that you actually clean the cappuccino makers at the end of your shift. That's really why we're here.
So I was actually just thinking, you just made me think of something, which is that, so I'm actually, I like Starbucks, you know, as a person who no longer drinks alcoholic beverages. Like, I drink a ton of coffee, and it is nice to have a place I can go that I know that I'm going to get a certain standard of coffee. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I'll say about Starbucks.
Yeah, it's the McDonald's of coffee.
McDonald's of coffee.
It's like I don't like McDonald's unless I'm in an airport and I don't recognize the other restaurants around me. Then I'm like, yay, McDonald's.
Yes, that's pretty much how I feel about Starbucks. But I also, you know a little bit about the corporate culture, and damn it, they seem to put a lot of energy into their corporate culture, right? Like, they want people who care about coffee to work there. That is like a part of who Starbucks is that you have these, like, and I'll say, I think in general, like, the Starbucks I go to, like, I think they do a pretty good job of, like, inculcating, like, a culture of customer service. That's how they should treat, you know, white supremacy and racism, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it should be just, they wouldn't do a one-day training about how to be a barista and then never say anything again.
Yeah, then never check in with you again about how it's going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they introduce new fucking drinks like every 2 days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, try to keep people fresh, right?
And on top of that, they also give, like, because I almost worked at Starbucks. I mean, I was hired by Starbucks back in the day when I was working day jobs, and I just decided that I didn't want to work those hours. But they also do a thing back then where it's like, if you invent a new thing, a new drink, or if you come up with some new product, they give you a bonus for that. Is there an anti-racism bonus? Is there like a, like they clearly, like they actually make it a part of your, it helps you out financially if you are a good Starbucks employee. And if you're, if you do, if you innovate as a coffee, as a barista, are they doing that for the racism?
Yeah. And that, I mean, I think this gets to sort of the general point, which is this, that can't be a one-time thing. It has to be something that, that goes throughout your culture and that people talk about all the time. And it turns out like that, the experts who review companies' attempts to have more, you know, minority representation in executive offices and whatnot, they say that the way that you actually affect people's implicit bias, as measured on, there are these tests that you can give people that involve showing like quickly pictures of images, like pictures of people, and then you have to kind of have a good or bad feeling about it. It's actually, it's not just like an easy question, like, do you like black people or not? It's a little bit more complicated than that. And what has a real effect on that, and in fact, what has a real effect on the presence of minorities and women in management is recruiting. And having, you know, integrated, having an integrated management will lead to more integration. So, yes. I mean, I guess it's just seeing the same thing, which is that if, like, for instance, one of the problems is that they have apparently have this store in Minneapolis that's like mostly black people. That's not a problem that's mostly black people, but they should do better about having more stores that have more people of color.
Well, I mean, it's no different than what happened with ABC recently. It's like there's all this sort of like ABC shouldn't have gotten into bed with Roseanne Barr in the first place, which I agree with, or I should, they at least should have been prepared for the consequences. But I definitely think the reason why they got leapt out of that bed quickly is because the woman who's in charge of ABC is a black woman.
Yeah.
And so she was like, that's actually my line. Like, that's enough. We're done. I don't care about the ratings. And so for me, it's like the same in the entertainment industry. Like, I always say this when I talk to students or people who want to get into showbiz, like the power is not on camera. The power is behind the camera. Same with Starbucks. The power is not in being a barista. The power is in being some sort of the high level executives who make the decisions about baristas. So if you invite those people in like Brian Stevenson or the woman from the NAACP, but I mean, give them full-time jobs or give them full-time consulting jobs where they actually have power, where they can actually vote. They can actually contribute to decision-making, not just on that day, but generally. And also make the other people in your company. I mean, like Uber recently, I saw they hired a guy who's a man of color. And I'm like, because of all the bad press they got, they were like, yeah, we need to really demonstrate to people that we're changing things around. They also hired a black woman because they're like, we need to demonstrate to people that we're changing things around. But it's also not just about those individuals. It's about lots of people.
Yeah, it's about doing rather than saying, basically. Yeah. I mean, like, this is not news to anyone.
The problem is that this means taking power out of the hands of white men, and that's where this usually falls apart. is that white men, on no matter what their political affiliation is, tend to not want to lose any of the power they have or don't even want the perception that they're losing power. So, I saw Howard Schultz on CNN, and he talked a lot of the talk, but the thing he was afraid to say when he was asked directly was like, was it racism when those guys got kicked out? He wouldn't even take the question on as a question. He sort of went down a whole other route, which is why he's a CEO, because they know how to do stuff like that. But, you know, like to me, it was just like, you can't even answer that question. Whereas like if it had been a black woman who was a CEO or a black man or a person of color, they would have been able to, yeah, that was racist and we shouldn't do that again. But he wouldn't in that moment. Maybe he said it other times, but he wouldn't take that on because he didn't want to lose power in that moment.
I also think it's interesting. You know, when I was reading to you what Starbucks wanted to do with these sessions, make everyone feel safe and welcome, and you pointed out that we all weren't invited. I mean, that's the other part of the training equation that, you know, didn't get addressed today, was that it's not just about being a barista there or being a manager there. There's this whole other side of, you know, the transaction.
It's, yeah, I mean, I think that the somebody said they should have live streamed it, and I agree with that. Somebody said they should, yeah, they should have made the training immediately available to all companies, corporations in America for free. There's all sorts of things they could have done, because the problem isn't that racism happens in Starbucks. The problem is that racism happens in America, and Starbucks is in America. And if they want to end racism in their stores, they actually have to work on ending racism in America. Like, they can't, it's not just like making Starbucks a racism free zone. It sort of makes racism like the, like those factories that say we've gone 100 days without a fatal injury. It's, you know, it's like racism's not just happening in that store. Like, it, like those injuries are just happening in the Ford factory. It's happening in America. And so I think that even the conception of it is like, we're just trying to protect ourselves. And I think that we're at a point in history where black and brown people, specifically because we're in the Trump era, are like, enough of the talk about these things. And I'm a person who advocates talking, but enough about the talk. You gotta be about it. And there's just a feeling that this, despite the very qualified people they invited in, that they're not actually being about it. Like, even the closing at 2:30.
What a sacrifice.
Because whatever money they lost, they gained back in like free advertising.
Yeah. The part about the customers that I wanted to get at was I really appreciated that one of the conversations that got started out of the event in Philadelphia was a lot of people of color unloading about what it's like, you know, to be a person of color in a white space and how that changes behavior and how that impacts your psyche. And I probably said this several times on this show before, but probably worth saying again, which is that I feel like I've been a pretty well-intentioned white person for most of my life. And yet it still takes me aback every time I read about a first person account of like the intimate ways that one's that who one is impacted by like being in a white space. Uh-huh. Like the physical changes that you have to make. Like a friend of mine was telling me, like he makes himself smaller in white spaces. Like he's kind of a big guy, so he kind of like hunches over a little bit, you know.
No, I mean I wrote about that right around the time of Ferguson. I wrote a piece for Vanity Fair, and I talk about the fact I'm 6'4", 200 and well now 260 pounds because it's been a, you know, baby weight. But people who've known me for years, if they don't see me for a few months, will go, I forgot how tall you were, because I actively don't stand at my full 6'4 height all the time. And I didn't know I was doing that, but I do know that I try to be, I'm aware of my impact on the world, and I'm aware of trying to be, create a less intimidating vibe, even though I'm not an intimidating person. Like, you know, I'm not, despite my size being connected with being intimidating, I'm not an intimidating person, but I'm aware that like, I have to sort of make sure that the world knows that I have to, for my own self-protection, really, more than anything else, that I'm not out to intimidate you. And when I got asked to leave that coffee shop, my wife went back to sort of not yell at, but you know, read for filth the woman who had told me to leave. And I wanted to go up with her because I wanted to hear what's my wife going to say? Like, she's got a grad school education. She's got all the words to make this woman feel bad. But I also was like, if I stand over my wife and over this woman, that creates an impression that I don't want to leave. And that could end up with the cops being called.
Yeah, that's the thing that I don't know if I hope I lose my astonishment at it or not. I guess it's just my whiteness talking, that it's not just about making yourself less intimidating because of it might avoid a conflict. It's because it risks one's life. Like
it's life and death.
It's life and death. Like if you standing up straight is a matter of life and death. And like I have a friend who says he doesn't wear hoodies anymore, period. Like just doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, now it's different, but I used to joke that I didn't wear flip-flops because I never knew if I needed to run. Like it was just like, you know, there's that, because I was like, I need to be able to get it moving quickly as possible. And I would see white guys in flip-flops and be like, white privilege. Now, I say that as someone who's wearing flip-flops right now, because I feel flip-flops are dad gear for getting out of the house and getting your kids out of the house quickly.
There you go. And also racism is over, right? So flip-flops for everyone.
But I do think, I would say as far as, I encourage you to figure out a way to lose your astonishment, because for me, astonishment is no different than pausing in an emergency situation. You got to be ready. You got to be ready to get in quickly. Like the thing that has happened over the last few months is like, if you think back like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago, or let's say 20 years ago, bad things happened. Cops would horrible things would happen, and racism, whether it was cops or average citizens, and people, we would just all just look at them from across the street and walk by. Then camera phones are invented. Okay, now we're filming it, but we keep walking by. Well, now the Starbucks situation, somebody films it, people start sort of speaking, and somebody's like immediately uploads the footage to the internet so people can see it and react in real time. And I think that we all have to get more involved.
Yeah, and I also don't want my, whatever my reaction is, to keep me from acting. And I guess I keep underscoring it just because I have to face anew every day, because it's not my life, that this is something that is the life of a lot of people that I care about, that this is a life or death issue. You know, those people could have been hurt at the Starbucks in Philadelphia because the police got involved. But I do want to point out that the person that uploaded the film did more than upload the film. In fact, the people in that Starbucks said something to the cops. There were white people in that room who did something. And that's, you know, worth pointing out. I mean, and I hope that continues to happen. I mean, that's the only way, that's what starts to change things.
Well, I mean, we had a situation here in Oakland a couple weeks ago that has been dubbed the Barbecue Becky situation.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yes.
Where a white woman, or a white-skinned woman, we don't know her ethnicity exactly, but certainly a fair-skinned woman, called the cops because she saw black dudes barbecuing in the park barbecuing at the lake in Oakland, which is like, where else are you going to barbecue as if not at the lake on a beautiful day? And she said they were in the wrong area, but people started yelling and confronting her, I'll say, and got on their phone and filmed things, and to the point where she got like chased away from the park, and the cops sort of came for her, like, you know, not for these two black men. And I feel like if that had been a year ago or 2 years ago, maybe people would have kept walking. Maybe they would have filmed it, but she would have called the cops. The cops would have come. Those dudes would have got arrested, like the dudes in Philadelphia. They maybe would have gotten released hours later, like those guys in Philadelphia, but still you had to spend hours in jail. Or maybe one of them's got a warrant for like a broken taillight, and then suddenly it turns into a big thing. Then that dude's not getting out of jail for months, or years if something happens. So to me, about the Barbecue Becky situation, is that people prevented that from that ending up with those two black men being in jail, you know, because they got involved. And I think we all have to get more involved in the way those people in Starbucks did, because we can't trust that it's just gonna work out.
Black Tux is the easy way to rent suits and tuxedos online. If you're a person that doesn't wear dresses but instead wears suits, you might be looking at all the options that people who wear dresses and skirts have to rent online. There is like a ton of them. I use those services. But if you're a tux or suit wearing person, maybe you don't know Black Tux. If you haven't checked out Black Tux in a while, you have missed a lot. They've got new complete looks and suit essentials for all your upcoming spring events and weddings. Black Tux makes stepping up your style for a wedding or special event easier than ever before, so you can make sure to look as great as your date. Now, they have stylist selected outfits and also the option to build a custom look. They have lots of new suits and tuxedos to choose from for all those big events. And you know, they are there. There are graduations. There are rehearsal dinners. There are weddings, lots and lots of weddings. And, you know, I never realized this, but apparently some guys want to change up their look every once in a while. I've always been jealous of the fact that you can wear the same tux to everything. But Black Tux allows you to do a little something different every time. And it's not expensive to do so. You don't have to have a whole wardrobe of suits. And Black Tux has a free home try-on that lets you see the fit and the quality of your suit months before the event. Now, as with the other rental outfits, your suit will arrive before the event. They actually have it arrive even earlier than a lot of the dress rental places. It'll arrive 14 days before the event. And then the returns are simple. You wear it, you turn heads, and then you send it back 3 days after the event. Shipping is free both ways, so you can stand out at your event for all the right reasons with Black Tux. To get $20 off your purchase, visit theblacktux.com/friends. That's theblacktux.com/friends for $20 off your purchase. The Black Tux, premium rental suits and tuxedos delivered. Journalist Mehdi Hasan is known around the world for his televised takedowns of presidents and prime ministers. He hosts Upfront on Al Jazeera and is a columnist for The Intercept. And in his new podcast, Deconstructed, Mehdi unpacks a game-changing news event of the week while challenging the conventional wisdom in a tight 30-minute package, a little quicker than what we do here. He starts his show with his take on one topic and what the mainstream news is getting wrong or what context is being missed. And then he goes into a deep analysis and conversation with his guest or guests of the week. And get this, his guests have included Judd Apatow, Bernie Sanders, and Hasan Minhaj. So he kind of covers the gamut, I would say, in terms of who you might be expecting. It's everyone from comedians to politicians to, for instance, Stefan Clark's fiance. So you're going to hear from a lot of different people. And the show has covered such topics as the violence in Gaza from the perspective of Israeli activists against the occupation and, of course, police shootings as through the eyes of the fiance of Stefan Clark. Also, he's talked about the dangers of John Bolton with former diplomats. As a Brit and a Muslim and immigrant based in Donald Trump's Washington, D.C., Mehdi Hasan gives a refreshingly provocative perspective on the ups and downs of American and global politics. Deconstructed is a show that cuts through political drivel and media misinformation to give you a straight take on one big news story of the week. It is out every Friday, just like this pod. You can listen and subscribe at theintercept.com/deconstructed or on any podcast platform. I'd like to be at a training for how to appropriately insert yourself into a like person being racist situation.
And the thing is, those types of things do exist. It's just Starbucks has to call those people. When I first saw the list of people that Starbucks had invited, I was totally fine with those people. But I'm like, where are the young activists who were like on the ground in Ferguson? Mm-hmm. where's Alicia Garza and Patrice Cullors and from Black Lives Matter? You know, where are those? Where are the Million Hoodies people? Where are the people who are actually in the streets doing the work who are not going to care if Starbucks hires them back or if not, aren't going to care about how it comes off? We're just going to deliver the message. There are people who can do that training. There's the Anti-Police Terror Project here in the Bay Area, which is about like about police terror. And for me, it's like those are the people who could go in there. And they certainly, even if you go in there and you don't want to be there, they're going to be thorough with you. And you're going to walk out feeling something because they're not going to let you walk out and be let you be bored. And I feel like that when I saw the list of people, I was like, that's fine. But where's the young? The reason why we're talking about racism so much in America right now is because of young Black activists of color, Black activists who are on the streets, on social media, who are signal blasting this work and who can talk the talk and aren't afraid of what. But what if the CEO of Starbucks doesn't hire me again? You know, they actually care more about justice than they care about capitalism.
Yeah, we should be real clear. I have a Trump supporter in my life who I care about. But one of the things he says a lot to me is, aren't race relations worse now than they've ever been?
people who fell asleep in history class.
Yeah, and I take a deep breath and I say, well, there was the Civil War.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, I mean, just recently. And I'm like,
you mean like the last 2 weeks?
Yeah. I'm like,
weeks ago, they were better than this.
I'm like, I think what you're saying is like the metaphor I use with him, which he does not like, but I'm like, you know, we have been in an abusive relationship with each other in this country, like people of color and white people. And mm-hmm. It's just now that we know it. It's just now that the white people are realizing it.
Yeah. It's no different. Is sexual assault worse than it's ever been in this country because of the Me Too movement?
Exactly.
It's like you're just hearing about it more. The thing I will say about race relations is that our president, Donald J. Trump, his behavior encourages people to be more openly racist, like Roseanne Barr. And so there is a different tenor to it than the white guy, the white lawyer in New York who went around the restaurant yelling at all the employees for speaking Spanish, maybe wouldn't have access to those feelings if President Trump wasn't in office. But those feelings still would have existed. He wouldn't have had access to that voice in that moment. But those feelings would have still existed inside of him.
I want to talk to you a little bit about how white people are thinking about this moment, because I saw an interview you did about your new season. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Where someone said, do you regret talking to Richard Spencer? And you don't. And
It's funny. I think I regret it less and less every day. I think every time somebody asks me that question, I start to I regret it less and less.
And more power to you, because I agree. I think your answer is like, I wish we'd aired it quicker, you know?
Yeah.
And I agree, because that would have given more context. And
yeah.
But what I really zeroed in on in your response to that was that you're done talking to TV villains. Mm-hmm. And you're done giving kind of like the good clip that is you sitting down with someone who wants to kill you. Well, kill you is a strong. Oh no, let's
someone who is an obvious enemy is what I call them. People who are like, right. You know, with James Bond villains.
You want to take away the opportunity. You're not going to give anyone the clip of you sitting down with someone who objects to your very existence.
Mm-hmm. Especially if that person is not. Yeah, like it might happen again because we'll make more seasons and things will ebb and flow, but I'm certainly not willing to do it with somebody who's not willing to have a conversation. But I also feel like that we did that at a specific moment in time. The moment in time has changed. Every day on TV, there's obvious villains. Obvious villain is one of them. And so for me, it's like, if we're going to do an episode about the Sikh community and Sikhism and their faith and their culture and you know how they have been marginalized in this country, why do I need to find some Yahoo who doesn't like Sikhs? Like, why? Like, we've already talked about how they're the victims of hate crimes. To me, it feels like I'm just taking up valuable TV time from another story that somebody else in their community could tell that would be amazing.
Well, I feel I really identify with this topic and your thinking on this, because when this show started out, the initial art for it was like George Washington in a pussy hat and George Washington in a MAGA hat talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's how that was not my conception for the show, by the way.
But graphic designers and marketing people.
I understand, like, that's what they went for. I mean, that was like sort of right. But the concept of the show has always been talking about difference, not just like having like two people from separate corners like come together. And the reviews, there's like half of the reviews in iTunes. I've stopped reading them, but I swear when I stopped reading them, half of them were like, I'm disappointed she didn't follow through on this wonderful idea about having dialogue to bring us together. I see, like, you know, Van Jones has a series where he was, I like Van. We're not going to shade on Van.
No. There was a lot of that. And yes. Van was just another person who was doing it. But he was a more interesting person because a lot of it was journalists who you didn't care about at all. So Van is a compelling person. So,
right.
I mean, I think I got to that place pretty early because when I talked to the Klan, nobody was talking about reaching across the aisle. And then... And when I talked to Richard Spencer, despite how it aired, it was before he was popular.
Right,
so
right.
Now that everybody's doing it, I'm like, yeah, I'm not. I felt actively this season like we can't just be repeating the thing. We can't be like doing the things we've done before, because if we're going to make this show for 10 years or more, we have to be reinventing it regularly. So for me, it was like, it was clear, like, we're not doing that. And there was a couple times where, like, we did an episode about Border Patrol in Arizona, and someone was like, what about Sheriff Joe R. Shut up. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not talking to Joe Arpaio so that can be the clip that runs incessantly before the very nuanced episode about the border, about U.S.-Mexico border runs, you know?
So we've talked about like that clip and like that is like good TV or whatever. But I guess what I'm curious about, I think there's a certain like white person fetishization of this idea that we get two people that disagree and we get them to talk, you know, like that's what America's about. Like,
it's like, who's the us who needs to talk? And that's my question.
Yeah.
So for me, I think the us who needs to talk is those of us who are really on the same page, but are unaware of it because we don't know enough about each other. So I had no idea how close the Sikh religion would sort of overlay with the civil rights movement, like, and how close that the like social justice aspects of the Christianity, like of the Black church, would overlay with the Sikh religion, because I'd never had a conversation with them before. And I had no idea that, like, the Black people who go to HBCUs, who I sort of always were like, those are the super blackity Black people who would never want to talk to me, would be like, no, a lot of us are the Black people like you who felt like we weren't Black enough when we came to a place to sort of learn about our Blackness. Oh, I didn't know we had so much in common. Like, that's the us that needs to talk. I think that this sort of, like, somebody just tweeted at me the other day, like, you should do an episode where you talk to Trump voters. And I was like, hey, I did an episode in Appalachia. I did an episode with the Klan. We did an episode about Muslims where we talked to a Muslim imam who voted for Trump. I was like, I talked to a ton of Trump voters, but you just want me to talk to the Trump voters that you want me to talk to. Yeah. And the way, and you want it to, and you want Trump to be the only conversation, as opposed to like when I went to Appalachia, Trump's name didn't come up because we were talking about how do we get more jobs here? What do you do now that coal mining is gone? But people want the thing that like the sort of the pretend conflict, and I don't have any interest in it. And also, if we're really honest with it, those Trump voters who are the base of the base, and I'm not talking about people who voted for Trump who like, I don't like Hillary or I always vote Republican. I'm talking people who are still
30%, yeah.
Yeah, the people who are still currently excited about him being president and think he's doing a great job, those people are for the most part not worth talking to because they're not actually engaging in reality.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not interested in them either. Like, I mean, I'm interested in them, I guess, in sort of a anthropological way.
Yeah, but not in that. But it's like if you're somebody who's in this country right now going, Trump is really doing a great job and not getting credit for all the great things he's doing. We barely speak the same language.
Yeah.
We would need a translator. Like, So I will certainly talk to someone who voted for Trump, but who's like, yeah, this isn't going how I thought, because that's the reality.
Yeah, I think that I am more interested in figuring out how we relate to each other, those people who maybe are still, yeah, who voted for Trump but aren't Trump supporters, like what that America looks like after maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but I do think and hope there's going to be a post-Trump era.
Well, just like for the same reason I don't want to talk to somebody who's still legislating Hillary's popular vote thing either. I can have the conversation with you about how, yeah, we need to get rid of the Electoral College because the popular vote should be the way to go. But I don't want to actually be talking about how do we get hit, like re-legislating Hillary's version of that. You know, I feel like I just feel like there's all these different discussions that I don't actually want to engage in on the left and the right. There's discussions of like, how do those of us who are on the right side of history actually come together as one group? That's the discussion I want to have.
I am fascinated by this question, especially when it comes to the Never Trumpers. You know, like I have friends who are basically neocons, right, on foreign affairs, who now are, you know, fighting arm in arm against what they also see as, you know, nascent fascism. But whoa, I hope we don't have to go through another Iraq war together, you know, how, I mean, this is more like I'm just personally kind of torn. I shouldn't say torn, but like, because I feel like I'm happy to fight side by side with them for now. You know, like their voices are helpful.
Yeah.
And also you see things like Bill Kristol admitting that, you know, he would have played the politics on Obamacare. You get things like you get people like Max Boot talking about his white privilege, you know. So I feel like there's interesting things happening.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, I feel like it's like now it's like almost it's like since we have a reality show president, it's like a reality show. Discussions come in. It's like alliances that are formed there's a bigger thing we have to deal with. We can form an alliance now, but eventually we're going to get back and talk about this. And that happens. I think black people are used to that. You know, there are black people in the street marching arm in arm with each other who don't agree on tons of things, but like for the bigger picture, we need to come together in the streets right now, you know, because as much as people think there's a huge difference between black people who are still sort of like the children of the civil rights movement who are still around, like, you know, there's many of those black people who are still around and active, who remember Dr. King and marched with Dr. King, who are like, Black Lives Matter is too far, but we can all show up in the streets together. We need to show up in the streets.
That is such a great point. I'm embarrassed that I haven't thought of it before, but you're right. Yeah. Like black people are used to having uncomfortable alliances. Like that you don't have to like undergo an implicit bias test if you want to march on the streets for Black Lives Matter, you know?
No, I mean, you know, the funny thing, like people, we're talking about Dr. King, they like, he didn't emerge as being the number one, he wasn't the natural like guy who was like, that's the guy who's going to save us, because they were like, who's the best person to be the front man for this? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so there was like discussions and negotiations. And some people were like, but he's too young. And I don't really know if I, but he's the best speaker. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's, he was a negotiated leader who ended up living up to the negotiations and sort of surpassing expectations. But like, I talked to a guy in our HBCU episode of United States of America who remembers Dr. King at Morehouse and was like, I mean, he was a snappy dresser, but nobody thought all that was going to happen.
I find a lot. That gives me a lot of hope, actually.
No, I just feel like we can't. We put too much magic in the past, and too many problems in the present. Like, no, let's actually. These things have to be negotiated sometimes, and these things have to be sort of like calculated. And you know, I mean, if I wasn't actually on this planet, I would be following the whole who the Democrats are going to run for president next in a really sort of fascinating, like sort of Game of Thrones way, because they have to figure it out. But are they smart enough to negotiate that end? Or are they going to do the thing where they go, it's your turn?
I'm
turn is it? I think Joe Biden gets another turn because he took a pass on his turn last time.
Yeah, he gave like up a turn. So he gets two turns now.
Yeah, he skipped a turn. It's like a Wheel of Fortune. He had to skip a turn. So it says turn next again. Are you actually smart enough to sort of go, okay, let's look at this on a big who out here can do it, and let's negotiate all aligning behind that person.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, no, it's going to be a shit show.
Or, you know, somebody we don't realize is great is going to turn out to be great. I mean, you know.
Well, that's what Obama was.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like,
But what Obama
Obama had that belief in himself before anybody else had that belief in him. So we're basically asking for Haley's Comet to come twice within 76 years.
Yeah, that seems unlikely.
it's just like, so I feel like, whereas I feel like the thing that I've been comparing it to is like, back in the 80s, the NBA just went to Africa and looked for tall dudes.
Okay.
Like, they were just like, okay, we've run out all of the tall dudes in America. You know who has a lot of tall black dudes? Africa. And that's how you got like some of the greatest players the NBA's ever seen, because they just went and recruited from, like, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon and Manute Bol. And
okay, I was
Patrick
wondering where the analogy was headed, and you're just saying that the Democratic Party needs to recruit, because I was like, okay.
Yeah. No.
Gonna try to figure this one out. Okay.
No, the analogy is that you actually have to go out there and do active recruiting and active beating of the bushes and go, hey, that comptroller has a really good jump shot. Maybe we can turn him into a congressman. You know what I mean? Like, you know, or a congresswoman. Let me say.
For what it's worth, I actually think there's something. I mean, I don't know my sports history well enough to be able to cite an analogy for this. But what I think is happening is people are like, "What, that guy can play? I can play." Like,
yeah,
and
but I think you have to still to get into big time electoral politics, you have to have somebody who actually, you know, it's like you can be. There's been many to sort of to ride my NBA analogy for more than it's worth. But there's many great basketball players who no team took a shot on them.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, so it's like you got to actually get in. You got to get in to quote Hamilton for the last time in my life, because I quote it too much. The room where it happens. Like, you got to actually be in the place where the stuff is happening, or else you're just, you know, somebody with a good voice and who has good teeth.
But also, I mean, I'm going to emphasize that because I know the cricket audience, sometimes we have some young people listening, and that everyone who thinks they possibly can run for office should give it a shot. Like, I think that it's open tryouts. You know, I think the Democratic Party. I'm totally serious. Is that like they create, you know, run for school board, you know, run for city council.
No, absolutely.
Like, if you have an idea and you have if you want to get something done, like, just go ahead and run. You know, like,
I agree,
maybe you'll never do anything else. Maybe you'll only serve on city council.
But you can make a bigger difference in your community on city council than you can as a congressperson, you know. So I think that, like, I 100% agree with you. I just think that if the Democrats aren't showing up in the back of city council meetings across this country with clipboards and stopwatches, like, sort of going like, oh, that was faster than I've ever seen anybody give a stump speech, you know, that then it's like, then you're just going to have a bunch of incredible city council people, you know, which is great.
It's better than what we have now. I mean,
it's better than what we have now. So, but I think that, like, you know, it's about really recognizing what the problem is and being able to actually actively work on it and realize that some of it's going to be negotiated. It's not just going to be like the halo of the next leader isn't just going to land on somebody.
Yeah. No, thank for that. That would make it easy. And that's not, I mean, they have a little saying, you know, God will do for me what I cannot do for myself, but he won't do for me what I can do for myself.
There you go. That's a good one.
Thank you. And that's how it works in politics, too. Well, this has been great. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm a huge fan of the show. I'm looking forward. I think that you have friend of the show, Alice Wong, on your show.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, she was on our show about the disability community. Yeah, no, she was great. And she's also, she's one of my, like, I realized, oh, no, she's more than just a friend. She's one of my mentors, specifically around those issues. Like, she will call me out. She'll reach out to me. She'll tell me what to read. Like, I just feel like, and I'm like, yep, Alice, sure, yep.
Yep. Yep. She's a really great person. And
that's an example of somebody who's like a natural leader.
Yes.
But what do we define the qualities of a leader as? And are we, we're basically defining them too narrowly.
Yeah. Except we both recognize that in Alice, right? That
yeah, we know, but I think what this comes down to, there needs to be more of us in the world. I mean, I think that's
honest. Well, I won't argue with you there. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Thanks for having me.
No matter who you are, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day to stay healthy. And Quip knows that. Their team of dentists and designers is focused on helping you take care of your mouth better. For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes while still packing just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. There's a built-in timer to help you clean, to move from place to place on your mouth, and you will brush for the dentist recommended 2 minutes with those guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Again, those would be helpful in all areas of life, would they not? Guiding pulses to know when to switch sides. I made a joke about parties last time, and maybe I'll make it again. It would be a useful thing for some Republicans out there, those guiding pulses. Anyway, next, Quip subscription plans are for your health, not just your convenience. They deliver a new brush head on the dentist recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O list and named one of Time's best inventions. And it is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they are backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25. And if you go to getquip.com/friends right now, you will get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com. That's getquip.com/friends. John Lovett, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
We're going to listen to the question. Here it is.
Hi, Anna. I love the podcast and just wanted to share a general comment question with you, just because I have the feeling you'll understand my point. We're living in a time when good people are trying hard not to speak or act in ways that are racist, anti-LGBTQ, misogynist, ableist, etc. So why in the world is it still open season on older people? It absolutely amazes me now that I'm paying attention. It literally seems to be a free-for-all. It's 100% acceptable even for woke people to ridicule and insult older people. I'm seeing examples of this all the time. One of those examples was from John Lovett, who I adore. A comment about the Zuckerberg hearings and how all of these Congress people are so old and thus obviously know nothing about technology. That idea is pretty funny to me. I'm 61 and have been a coder for decades, and many of the smart, experienced people I work with are over 60. We know exactly how to use technology, like our contemporaries Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, etc. And that includes using social media well, which frankly isn't very difficult. I also know lots of non-tech professional older people who just stumbled fearlessly into using technology and have a great time with it. In my experience, these are typical older people. And guess who generally appears pretty hapless and bad with technology? Many young people who seem to know absolutely nothing except for how to use social media on a smartphone. Faced with a laptop or the idea of communicating with more than emojis or something other than a pic, many are comically helpless. Though I wouldn't make a crude, insulting joke about it. Those Congress people don't know anything about social media because of their own personalities and priorities. Not because when you get your first gray hair, you somehow are unable to comprehend posting and liking things. It's bullshit at the level of asserting that women are weak-minded and over-emotional, or any other gross unwoke stereotype. It's extremely unwoke. Why is it so common? Of all the things that could be said about Bernie Sanders, why is it always lame jokes about his chronological age? How is this okay?
So, John, do you have anything to say in your defense?
I wouldn't even say it's in my defense. It's just something. Yes, I suppose I do.
You can just cop to it, too. You can just say, like, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't have said that. It's tough. Well, we don't think about age in the same way we think about other identities.
So I would say that it is wrong to say, to dismiss a whole generation as not knowing technology. I do think it's fair to note that a bunch of septuagenarian senators did a terrible job of asking questions about technology that was invented late in their lives. And while there are many baby boomers and older people who are incredibly adept at technology, and many young people who are, you know, Luddites trying to break the Gutenberg press, you know, because of what it's up to.
Right.
With its easily
movable type.
I guess I'd say it's a fair concern, and I'm glad you raised it. It is true that it's more acceptable to mock older people as a group.
It's also acceptable, like, okay, so I'm Gen X squarely. Uh-huh. Gen X. You are...
I am millennial first wave. I'm...
Right. And so it's I was about to say, so in the millennial second wave, those are the ones that I used to feel really safe mocking myself.
Right.
Like the lizard people, like generation. And with their avocado toast and their lack of mortgages. And I've come around to being like, that was actually pretty not good of me to do.
I think it's okay because...
But comedy relies on generalization, so...
Yes. Well, here's why I think it's okay. By definition, I mean, an entire generation can't be a, you know, it's not about punching up or punching down, right? When you're making fun of a whole age cohort, I think it's a, like, everybody can just sort of take a joke. I'm just thinking a lot about it. I'm thinking about why I think it's okay.
Well, I think also one of the things that maybe needs to happen then when we're talking about generations is a lot of the time, and I plead guilty, I just did this. A lot of the time when we're talking about generations, we really are talking about white people in that generation.
You know, I've been thinking about that too. Like, I make fun of baby boomers a lot, and I joke about, you know, the baby boomers and, you know, the World War II generation, they built the highways. And, you know, what are you people up to? You know, you're just spending down our inheritance and, you know, getting Social Security and blah, blah, blah.
Not knowing how to use the internet.
But it is true. I am more squarely mocking white baby boomers for their generation's greediness overall.
And then and people of color who are millennials are not had, like, I think have some pretty good reasons to be nervous about mortgages.
Oh, I reject outright the critic. I never
you're
criticize.
Not you never did lizard people jokes like I did.
No, I do not. I find the kind of look at these millennials. Jabuki Young White, who's a comedian who's been on Love or Leave It a couple times, he has this funny bit about how, what's up with millennials and why aren't they buying more diamonds? You know, it's like they don't have any money. So I cannot stand criticisms of millennials and the younger generation because I believe that we as a group are being, me, I'm older, but the younger generation is being handed a mess. And a lot of the things they're criticized for are the natural way of handling being, you know, handed a bunch of, it's like, why do these millennials have shit all over their hands? Like, well, maybe you handed them a shit sandwich.
Yeah.
Older nuts.
I made a lot of more of those jokes. And I didn't actually make jokes about financial responsibility and avocado. I made avocado jokes, but I didn't make jokes about financial stability so much as I think I did a very lazy kind of humor about, you know, safe spaces and trigger warnings. And actually, I was working at MTV with Mukta.
Hey, Mukta.
And a bunch of young people who were, it's one of the most incredibly diverse workplaces I've ever been in. And kind of just listening for a change, which I'm not especially good at all the time if I don't have headphones on. And I came to realize, like, these people that I was making fun of for being sensitive, that's good to be sensitive. It's like, and that it's not about, like, overweening preciousness. It's about a concern for the feelings of others. And that's something that, you know, should be probably encouraged.
Yeah, I definitely am also very dismissive of this idea that, like, oh, you know, the younger, they're snowflakes and they're too sensitive and they're too coddled and trophy generation and all that. I don't buy that. I think a lot of the changes are good. I think there's still built into our conversation about young people a lot of, like, a lot of stuff about masculinity, about being tough, about what you're supposed to endure, about what that endurance does to you, with absolutely no evidence that it's good. Yeah. It's just, you know, I got beat up when I was in high school. It's good. Why? What are you talking about? So I find that ridiculous. I also think, yeah, obviously it's a racket, this, you know, PC culture police nonsense. But even if you think there's a legitimate problem going on with young people not being open to other points of view, and you don't, you can broaden it out beyond young people, and you can say that actually, in our, as our culture, as a culture, we're becoming less tolerant of diverse points of view. I don't know if I agree with that, but even if you do agree with it, I think it is obvious that the threats to free speech are not kids on campus. It's the government and corporations silencing the people who work for them, and the ways in which people do not feel free on a day-to-day basis to speak their minds, not because of what a college campus is going to do, but because of what their bosses are going to do.
Right. And also structuring our education system so that we actually don't have a lot of college campuses where free speech debates are even happening. What we have is a lot of community colleges and a lot of for-profit colleges where they're not even... That's where most Americans get educated, and they don't have these debates about free speech at all.
Yeah. So,
and I actually was going to say, to bring it back to ageism to older people, that I also used to make a lot of fun of baby boomers, and I was a little punk rocker. I hated fucking hippies, but I think maybe I hated them or said I hated them or was snarky about them for the same reasons I was snarky about young people, which is that, is this something about sensitivity that is I react to?
Yeah.
And maybe actually... Again, like, it's something that should be encouraged, if not actually, like, even if I can't actually do it myself.
Yeah, I'm here's the question. Is it like, do I think I should stop making fun of baby boomers at shows? And I clearly think the answer is no. I would like to keep doing it and plan on continuing to do it. I think the reasonable point to make is don't dismiss an entire generation. I think it is entirely...
What about the... Just, but actually, because we did bring it up, and I think you also admitted it, you are talking about white baby boomers.
Yes. I think I'm predominantly talking about white baby boomers. However, I do think I'm still talking about a larger generational force when I talk about... maybe that's all it is. Maybe I really am just talking about... maybe that's the compromise.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep making fun of baby boomers.
But I'm going to specify
that they're white as hell.
But those are the people that left the mess. Those are the people. It's the bankers and the, you know, mortgage industry. And, like, it is white baby boomers. It isn't...
I guess what it really is, it's
politicians. They're white.
It's class. It's...
Yeah.
Which does fall, especially the older you get, more neatly by along racial lines. But what I am talking about is a upper class of baby boomers that accrued a lot of wealth, put it into their houses, built policies to make sure they stayed successful, make sure they got resources, make sure they got Social Security and Medicare, while dooming the rest of us, including poor baby boomers.
Yep.
And poor people of color and young people of all colors. So... Wow. Look at that.
Look, we got somewhere.
We got somewhere pretty cool. Now, I will say on the technology front, I will say that I would like to make fun of older people of all races.
Who can't use their phones.
Can we make that a compromise?
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And that is it for the show. If you have a question for With Friends Like These, you can write us at withfriendslikepod@gmail.com. Please send an audio version of the question if you can. If you can't, that's fine too. We are looking for the intersection of politics and the personal. So questions about how relationships have affected your politics and how your politics have reflected your relationships are the kinds of things we want to know about. And of course, any uncomfortable conversation that maybe you don't know how to have. That's again withfriendslikepod@gmail.com. Thank you for making it all the way to the end of the show. that means you're a super fan and you know what I always ask. Please rate and review on iTunes if you can. If you can't, that is totally cool too. Just keep listening because we'll be back next week.